you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Are you a friend of ours who loves to get discounts? Come down to CITO, more deals than you can count. We've partnered with some local businesses, so come down to us to get your card before it's too late.
As a member of CITR Discord, you get amazing deals with some of Vancouver's finest local businesses, such as Corner's Pub, Australian Boot Company, The Bike Kitchen, Rufus Guitar Shop, Vinyl Records, and the Cinematheque. For more information, visit CITR.ca/friends.
LGBTQ.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway. Oh, Dave, I like your shave.
And we're the Daves. I'm David Badanek.
I'm Dave Campbell.
I'm Dave Frank.
We're the Daves.
And you're listening to CITR FM 101.9.
CITR Radio.
And these are the Daves of our lives. It is Friday, the 9th of November, 2018, and this is Dave Radio with Radio Dave on the radio. We're broadcasting live on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming on the World Wide Web at CITR.ca from our studios underlooking the agora of the Palatial Student Nest on the Musqueam territory of Ulksan, better known to you as the Point Grey campus of the University of British Columbia. On the program today, we'll learn about Mine, a new piece by Theatre Replacement based on the game Minecraft. We'll also hear about Pieces of Eight, a happier, lighter play about the Vancouver housing crisis. And singer, songwriter, actor, poet Rodney DeCrew will be here to tell us all about his upcoming tribute to Canadian poet and working class hero Al Purdy. Plus, we'll do call board and lots of local music. It's Vancouver's go-to hour for local independent theater, film, and music. And it starts right now. Don't touch that dial. And Meiko Yamamoto is on the line. Hello, Meiko.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. So
you have done a play with the cooperation of your 11-year-old son.
That's right.
About a very popular game called Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know what Minecraft is, like me, tell us a little bit about that first.
Minecraft is a computer construction game. It's a block-based sandbox game, if that makes sense to anybody, where you essentially get spawned in an infinite world, usually a forest or a biome that doesn't have any structures in it or civilized. They've got some villages, but not much civilization. And you can play in two modes, creative and survival. And in survival, you basically have to defend yourself and you have to earn or mine or everything that you and build everything that you have to survive and have a good life. And in creative, you can just create infinitely and you have access to all kinds of materials. And it's a lot like painting in creative. I find it very artful.
Mm-hmm. And your son, Hokuto is is very adept at this game. What was it that inspired you to make a piece of theater out of it?
It's really a popular game among kids. Yeah. Much to the, I don't think that the inventors of the game really intended for it to be so popular among kids. That's the phenomenon about Minecraft, is that it has become so popular with the younger generation. And as a result, there's been a lot of lateral mentorship that's happened. So you see a lot of times when people are interacting, it's kids that are teaching adults how to do very complex coding structures, basically, with the different materials in the game. And when my son first started playing, he was about 8 years old. He was playing on his iPad Pocket Edition. Mm-hmm. And he was immediately obsessed with it, as many kids get. And I realized it was causing kind of a big rift between us, because I grew up in the generation of, screen time is to be limited and it can be harmful to you and all the rhetoric around that. So he really, really wanted to play all the time, and I really didn't want him to play all the time, and it was causing fights, and it was really an upsetting time. And then I started to do some research and found a really great camp here in Vancouver called McKids Academy, where this woman has sort of developed this whole homeschooling program around Minecraft. And we enrolled him in the day camp, and it was like he had found his people, We walked into the room and he just had a community. They had developed a lot of really excellent codes of conduct, how to play safely and how to play with other people productively and positively online. And after I sort of learned a little bit more about that, the next time he asked me to play, I said yes. And so we started to play together, and I noticed this very, very interesting dynamic that emerged, which was, even though we still had the parent-child bond and I was still his mom, he was now sort of the parent in the game. He was taking care of me, teaching me how to do things, giving me potions to heal me and to see in the dark, changing my skins, which is the clothes that you kind of wear in the game, and making beds for me and telling me when it was time to go to sleep. And so,
I bet he liked that.
I think he thought it was really great. I think he thought he was helping me a lot.
Yeah.
And that really made him feel good. And it made me feel good too. And so it sort of struck me that it would be a really interesting experimental form. And I make theater, so it just sort of became a natural progression of the idea.
Mm-hmm. And so what came of that? What's the theater experience now?
Essentially, what you're watching is a group of 8 gamer performers between the ages of 10 and 46 on stage, mm-hmm. enacting different narratives that revolve around a mother and son connection.
Yeah.
And those involve, we pop culture, we touch on the Terminator franchise. We also tell the story, say, of Grendel's mother's revenge from Beowulf. But we also draw upon our own personal experience and stories, and we kind of mash them up with these found narratives in order to create this, sort of episodic experience where we're in game all the time and we're always playing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really nice sort of structured improvisations. While we're sort of telling one story, the kids are moving forward in the realm, which is the world that we play in, and starting to build the scenes and the sets for the next narrative. So whenever we encounter them, we don't know what they've built, and sometimes it's pretty surprising.
Wow.
And leads to all sorts of really great, exciting moments. The show, we've been working on it. The core group of players has been working on it for a while, and we're all adults. And when we bring the kids into the room, that's really when the show comes to life.
Yeah.
They're really bringing that level there.
Well, it sounds kind of like a slice of life kind of thing, where you're dealing with the events and the stories happening in the game, but also with the characters on stage.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're hoping to bring, is this sort of overall experience of you're watching people play a game, but you're also imbuing them with the narratives, and that's reaching across to an audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're coming pretty close to opening night. You're playing at the Shadbolt next week.
Yes.
And then you're taking it to Britain.
Yeah, we're taking it on the road. Theater Replacement does a lot of international touring, and we were really lucky to receive a commission for this project by a really great organization in the UK called Future Art Centres. And so we're getting to tour the work to London, to a great center called Arts Depot, and to Cambridge at this great venue called Cambridge Junction. So we'll be there in March of 2019.
All right. So if people want to see the show at the Shadbolt, where can they get more information and tickets?
They can go to the Shadbolt's website, the Shadbolt Center for the Arts, or they can also go to theaterreplacement.org right. and just look on the page for Mine. There's a link that takes you directly to the ticket page for the Shadbolt.
All right. So the show is called Mine. It's at, it's at the Shadbolt next week. And Meiko Yamamoto, thanks very much for taking some time to tell us about it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Oh, I'll cut her off. Okay, Ronnie Nekru is here, and he's ready to tell us all about all things Al Purdy and all the rest of it. We're going to take a moment, though, to tell you about something else first, and that is, where is it? It's right here. Our friends at Ardent Tribe are doing a benefit concert at the Fairview Pub tomorrow night, and this is to help raise money for Bowden Lalonde's Muscular Dystrophy Charity. And it'll be a great night of soul and world beat music at the Fairview Pub with Ardent Tribe. So once again, that's Ardent Tribe, and they're going to be at the Fairview Pub tomorrow night. With us here right now is Rodney DeCrew. Hi, Rodney.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you are here because you're doing a big tribute to Al Purdy.
Yes.
And who is we're celebrating his 100th anniversary this year.
His 100th? He would have been 100 years old today.
Wow.
Or no, sorry, on the 24th.
Okay, close enough.
Around this time.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're celebrating 100 years of Al Purdy.
Mm-hmm. So who's Al Purdy?
Al Purdy is a iconic Canadian poetry, and I think he was the first truly Canadian poet because, I mean, there were other poets, of course, like Leighton who preceded him. So,
yeah.
But there was just something so profoundly unique about Al because, you know, he came from a lower working class family. He had very limited education. He wrote in total obscurity for the first three, 4 decades of mm-hmm. his writing career. So, and for good reason. I mean, Al said it himself. The poems weren't very good. But then all of a sudden, he made this shift into this a voice nobody had ever heard before in Canadian poetry that was accessible, that was really connected to working people and everyday people and the land and Canadian places. And when other Canadian poets were getting, you know, Canada Council grants to tour the world. I was going to the Canadian Arctic, you know,
yeah.
And you know, so he was really devoted to writing about the world the Canada that he knew, in a voice that sounded like nobody else.
Yeah, but it also sounded very familiar.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. That's totally right. I mean, it was
like it's the kind of poetry that your dad would have written if he was a poet. You know,
exactly.
That, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's for me, that was what was really special about Al. I discovered him in my early 20s,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's well known, and for people who know my story, I was a pretty messed up young guy, right? I was struggling with drug and alcohol addiction. I was on and off the street,
mm-hmm.
you know, had a bit of a criminal record. And then I found this I'd been trying to write poetry because I'd come across some of it in high school, but it was dreadful. And then I was at a party telling this guy, I was reciting some of this horrible doggerel that I was writing that was meant to sound like John Donne or something.
Yeah.
And he laughed at me.
Of course.
And he said, you know, if you're going to read poetry and try to write poetry, here, you got to check this guy Al Purdy out.
Yeah.
And I read Piling Blood. And that's a poem about, you know, work, these horrible, degrading jobs that he was doing that time in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it just hit me. So his poetry really kind of, I went, oh, so poetry can be like this.
Yeah.
And it saved me. I mean, I just feverishly became obsessed trying to write poetry. And mm-hmm. it kind of led me out of that world that I was stuck in. Yeah.
Have you got anything of Al's that we could take a look at? I'm kind of throwing this at you, but I know you sent me a link to Piling Blood, and I'm just looking for it right now.
We could read Piling Blood. You know, the funny thing was I brought the Beyond Forgetting collection, but
uh-huh.
I didn't actually bring any of Al's poems, which was kind of silly. I don't know why I did that. We could read Piling Blood. I got to warn you, though, you know, there are a couple lines that are problematic now in Piling Blood.
Yes.
You know, but, you know.
Some of the language, it's not necessarily, you know, foul language, but it is.
No, well, it's not that.
It is controversial.
Yeah, because he makes reference in that poem to being covered in the powdered blood, which
yeah.
then looks like blood, and he makes a reference to being scalped.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, so you can see why that poem has become problematic for some people.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame that those lines are in there for that reason, and because otherwise it's a wonderful poem.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know of a more working class poem that I've read by a Canadian poet.
Yeah. Can you see it from here?
Yeah, I can, actually.
Yeah? You want to give it a shot?
I'm not entirely blind, yeah. Piling blood. It was powdered blood. In heavy brown paper bags supposed to be strong enough to prevent the stuff from escaping, but didn't. We piled it 10 feet high, right to the shed roof, working at Aero Transfer on Granville Island. The bags weighed 75 pounds, and you had to stand on two of the bags to pile the top rows. I was 6 feet 3 inches and needed all of it. I forgot to say, the blood was cattle blood, horses, sheep and cows, to be used for fertilizer, the foreman said. It was a matter of some delicacy to plop the bags down softly, as if you were piling dynamite. If you weren't gentle, the stuff would belly out from bags in brown clouds, settle on your sweating face, cover hands and arms, enter ears and nose, seep inside pants and shirt, reverting back to liquid blood, and you looked like you'd been scalped by a tribe of particularly unfriendly Indians and forgot to die. We piled glass as well. It came in wooden crates. Two of us hoisting them off trucks into warehouse, every crate weighing 200 pounds. By late afternoon, my muscles would twitch and throb in a death-like rhythm from hundreds of bags of blood and hundreds of crates of glass. Then at Burns Slaughterhouse on East Hastings Street, I got a job part-time shouldering sides of frozen beef, hoisting it from steel hooks, staggering to and from the refrigerated trucks in eerie freezing rooms with breath a white vapor among the dangling corpses and the sound of bawling animals screeched down from an upper floor with their throats cut and blood gurgling into special drains for later retrieval. And the blood smell clung to me, clung to clothes and body, sickly and sweet. And I heard the screams of dying cattle, and I wrote no poems. There were no poems to exclude the screams which boarded the streetcar and traveled with me till I reached home, turned on the record player, and faintly in the last century heard Beethoven weeping.
Piling Blood by Al Purdy.
Nobody was writing poetry like that.
No.
At that time in Canada.
No, that's some powerful stuff. So yeah. I can understand when you read that.
Those kind of jobs.
Yeah.
And I came from a family of, you know, a long line of coal miners and steel workers and railroad workers, really hard physical jobs that, you know, and it wasn't just the jobs themselves, it was also the way you were treated.
Yeah.
Right. And he captured that in that poem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nobody talks about that.
No.
You know, how was your day at work?
Oh, I listened to cattle screaming.
Yeah.
As they're slaughtered.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. That's really something.
Yeah.
So you've got, you're doing a big tribute. At the Culch.
Yeah. The Harbor Books released a collection called Beyond Forgetting.
Uh-huh.
And it's a collection of tribute poems by Canadian poets and songwriters.
Right.
I have one in there about Al. And so for the night, we're going to have some of the poets who are in the book read their poems, a handful. And then Al Mader, the minimalist jug band, is going to play a couple songs. And Shiloh Lindsay, a country artist, is going to do a couple songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll be playing a concert with me and my band and I. And it's going to be hopefully a wonderful night celebrating
Al. Yeah, it really does. Did you ever get to meet him yourself?
Yeah. My first interaction with him was actually via phone, because I was 1996, so I would have been I was 25 years old, so it was even before that, and I was living in East Van, and I was reading Naked with Summer in Your Mouth. That was his the collection he had just released, and I wrote this poem called Notes to Al, an open letter to Al Purdy, and I thought I'm gonna call him, read him my poem. So I dialed up directory assistance and asked for Ameliasburg, Ontario, do you have an A. Purdy? And they did. So he answers, I call in a number and he answers the phone. He's, hello? I was like, is this Al Purdy?
Yeah, who else would it be? What do you want?
And I said, well, who are you? And I'm like, well, my name's Rodney, and I'm a poet. And he said, I can't say this word, but he said, well, who the F else would be calling me? And I said, well, I've read all your poetry, because you only read what I published.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, well, I've read what you've published, and I love it, and I wrote this poem, an open letter to Al Purdy, and can I read it to you? And he said, well, I don't think I can stop you. And then he laughed, and I read the poem. And it was a long poem, and the poem put a lot of questions to him, like, why the hell am I doing this? I'm dreadful at it. Nobody reads poetry. Nobody cares. I'm broke, and I'm dedicating my life to this.
Yeah.
And he laughed in all the right places, and I heard him going, as I read it. And at the end of the poem, he says, well, that was a hell of a poem, Rodney. And I'm making him sound like the yogi, the bear.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he said, that's a hell of a poem, Rodney, which it wasn't, but he was kind enough to say that.
Yeah.
And then he talked to me for about half an hour, and he said, you know, he said to me, Rodney, I've published a lot of books. I've won awards. I'm in a very good place in my career as a poet now. He said, but the only thing that matters is for me is writing the next poem. Mm-hmm. And he says, you gotta get clear on that.
Yeah.
And I knew he wasn't lying to me, because even though he was so respected, you might think, well, that's easy to say, right? But I knew he had spent 30-some years writing when nobody cared.
Yeah.
Right? So, and then he just kept telling, and then he said to me, just keep writing. Write. He said, don't worry about creative writing schools. Don't worry about any of that, because he knew where I came from, because we talked about it.
Yeah.
I was like him. I was from I had no education. Nobody in my world talked about poetry. Becoming a poet wasn't even something you would laugh at. People would be like, what? So he knew I had to find my own way. So it was a massive bolt. And then I met him a couple other times. Mm-hmm. The poem in Beyond Forgetting is about this sort of notorious night at the Vancouver Press Club. that happened where Al had caused a bit of a ruckus. So I got to meet him a few times, and every time he was incredibly generous with me and really encouraged me. And at that time, nobody was publishing my poetry or even reading my poetry.
Yeah,
it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some might say that's the case now, but at least I get published.
That's right. That's sort of where the dividing line is. Well, you brought your guitar in.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's like Chekhov's knife, you know. You have to, if you bring it in, you have to use it.
Well, yeah, I can play a song.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, pull it
let's
over.
Hope
it,
let's hope it stayed in tune. Because wants to listen to me tune a guitar on the radio.
Oh, that's always exciting there.
Oh, look at that. We're
is that fine. Good enough?
That's good enough for
Alrighty.
Me.
Alrighty.
So what should I play? Oh, you know what I'm going to play? I'm going to play a song called Blackbird. This is a brand new song. Some people say you should never play a new song.
Really?
Well, when something fresh, you should wait. Because, you know, you fall in love with everything you write.
Yeah.
It's new. And then it's like 6 months later, you're like, oh my God, I played that in front of people. But I like to live dangerously. Blackbird, blackbird, perched in a tree, staring down at me. See the clouds floating in the sky, a vast ephemeral army. And the boy I never was, and that angry, drunk young man, and all the years I lost, I'll never understand, oh blackbird. Oh blackbird. Blackbird, blackbird, please take flight. Fly away from me. Your eyes, your feathers are like eternal night, and I just want to be free. To walk in the sun and breathe the ocean air, and maybe forget that you were ever here, oh blackbird, oh blackbird, 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 I dream of a sky that goes on without end. And all the birds, they fly so high, carried by the wind. And all the songs they sing are lighter than the air. And all the songs they sing have never known despair, oh blackbird. Oh blackbird. Blackbird, blackbird, the day is growing late, and night is soon to fall. Oh, blackbird, blackbird, don't fly too far away. I'll be listening for your call. For you and I, oh, we are the same. You and I, we sing a song of pain, oh, blackbird. Oh, blackbird. Blackbird, blackbird, perched in a tree, staring down at me.
Rodney DeCru, thanks a lot for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
So the tribute to Al Purdy. It's called Beyond Forgetting, which is also the name of the book. It's a book launch and a concert.
Yep.
And it's all happening at the Culch Historic on the 22nd of November.
22nd. Yeah. You can get your, if you go to the Culch website, you can find, you can buy tickets online.
Yeah. And they're only $20, so that's,
yeah,
that's great. A great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming in. This was highly entertaining.
Great. That's our aim.
All right. So stick around, because coming up next, we're going to talk to Nathan Narusis about his new play about the Vancouver housing crisis.
Are you starting fresh this year and looking for new, exciting activities to do with friends on campus? Did you watch theater in high school and now miss it? Feeling overwhelmed and need a break? Come and escape to another world through thrilling live performance right on campus. Celebrate with us the 60th anniversary of UBC Theatre and Film's 2018-19 season. Still need more convincing? It's only $11.50 for UBC students with your card. And bring your ticket into Kerner's after the show to get 10% off your food. Check out theaterfilm.ubc.ca today.
All right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it raw. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay, okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. Montreal? What the f***?
It's a script.
I couldn't even... What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival. Fountain just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that. Because even a f***ing elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR Production Department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
And speaking of which, in the studio right now, we've got Nathan Narusis. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good. And you are the author of a new play called Pieces of Eight, which is going to be playing at Studio 16, which is at 7th and Granville, in a couple of weeks, November 21st. Right. So this is your second play?
Correct.
Yes. Yeah, your first one was on a few months ago called Cashless.
Right.
Yeah. So you like to write about pressing social issues.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Political issues that maybe don't get a lot of discussion otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And the big one right now is, of course, you know, our housing crisis. We just had a civic election, and there seemed to be a lot of talk about it, but it's something that really people don't really know what to do about it.
Yes, and I wanted to write a play that looked at maybe a different potential solution to it, or at least one that does not get discussed very often, and mm-hmm. that's the idea of people creating their own co-op housing projects without waiting for approval from government or funding from government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean the situation itself is it's one of those things where everyone sort of has a simple solution to it, but it's reflective of a broader international situation. It has to do with globalization and immigration and public policy.
Yes.
And it affects people in so many different ways. Like, there are small businesses that are unable to keep staff because
right.
they can't pay enough wages to sustain the expensive rents in the area.
Yes.
You know, it just cascades out that way.
Everything's getting very distorted.
Yeah.
I mean, when I wrote my play, I was aware of the fact that if this is an idea that not many people have talked about, maybe there are serious practical problems with implementing it. And that's why I thought it would make an interesting story, a funny story, hopefully, of people, because the financial aspect of it is fairly straightforward, and the banks are willing to work with people, unrelated people who want to simply form groups and purchase houses. But I was told from the research that I did, these groups often break apart because of internal politics, internal difficulties. And so I thought, well, how could you organize a group that really was built to last, and what would be the problems that might come up in it while that happens? So that was the way I wrote it.
Well, let's sort of take it right back to the beginning on that. Now, you said that they're looking for an alternative way to create co-op housing. So what is the structure that we're faced with right now?
Well, my understanding of the way most co-op housing works is it's legacy programs that have existed for decades
mm-hmm.
where the government either bought the building or signed a long-term lease with the owners, and they set aside money to subsidize people's housing. And eventually these leases run out, and if the government's pressed for money from other demands for it, which is always the case, then
mm-hmm.
then these people in co-op housing have to fight just to continue to exist.
Right, and it also depends on the party in power. And so, people that go into a situation thinking they've got some kind of secure housing are all of a sudden left to kind of fend for themselves. So what's the solution in your play?
Well, what I had the people in my play talking about was, well, you know, if two people can no longer afford a house in Vancouver, you know, two average people, then what would happen if you had eight people of varying levels of income and net worth banding together to purchase a single property large enough so that they could live in it comfortably? The building in the play is a 5,000 square foot house
mm-hmm.
that conveniently for the play is already set up as five separate suites with their own entrances.
Yeah.
And so eight people move into it, and they set themselves up just as a simple company, that the company itself owns the house, the company pays the mortgage, and then the eight people rent from the company. But the company itself is controlled by the eight. You know, they're all the eight people that have gotten together are all shareholders of the company.
Yeah.
So it's a way to have a bit more formality, because any group has to have some kind of organization, some kind of leader.
Yeah.
And so they thought they would try the characters thought they would try the basic corporate structure. And now, of course, it's never quite that simple when you're living in close proximity with people.
Well, yeah. And, yeah, I was just going to say, that sounds simple enough. What could go wrong?
Yes, and so I tried to put in as much realistic problems as I could think of that might happen in that kind of circumstance. Because I don't think it has really been tried very much. I'm sure there are groups like this that are simply existing, maybe a little bit under the radar, because it's sort of a gray area when it comes to occupancy bylaws. I mean, if a house has separate suites, that's one thing. But I had read an article that actually was one of the things that gave me the idea to write the play. I'd read an article about seven people who were renting a mansion in Shaughnessy. Now, presumably, their rent was quite reasonable, and it was a 7,000 square foot mansion, so it was like 1,000 square foot square feet per person.
Oh yeah.
But when I looked at the rent they were paying, I thought, well, they must have, you know, it must be a special circumstance. You know, maybe the estate, you know, owns the mansion or whatever, and doesn't need market rent.
Right.
And I looked at it and I thought, well, it's great, these people are all getting along. But what happens when, you know, it made me really sad when I thought, well, they're just as vulnerable as any other renter.
Yeah.
Even though they're comfortable at the moment. So.
Yeah, because they don't control the ownership.
That's right.
Of the building.
They don't own the property.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, as you know, going back to what we're saying about, you know, what the obstacles are, is there some kind of issue where this isn't like I said, it seems like a very simple solution, and that you know, as long as people get the financing together, it could work. But are there other obstacles in the way, like government regulations?
Well, I would imagine, from my research, I would imagine the biggest obstacle is going to be people don't like the idea of houses in their neighborhood that maybe used to have three or four people in them suddenly having 9 or 10 people in them. And I think that's, unfortunately, it's probably just a knee-jerk reaction, because if these are, you know, as I said in one of my other comments in the website, these are sort of what's left of the middle class. These are people that you would think wealthy people would have no issue with, you know, moving into their neighborhood. Sorry, I should be polite how I put it. I mean, I'm not trying to provoke any kind of class warfare here, but I guess what I'm trying to say is I suspect that it's the occupancy bylaws were set up 100 years ago or so to preserve the qualities of neighborhoods. Well, I mean, we've gotten to a point in this city where I think that even people who are very wealthy in ideal setups are not going to be happy with the way the city looks in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
If it, you know, becomes more and more like, I don't know, I guess eventually Rio de Janeiro or something, where you simply have gated communities for the few wealthy, and they helicopter from that to the airport, and then you have the rest of the city. I think it'd be a really sad thing.
And everybody else is kind of stacked up in little boxes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's not to anybody's interest, even the elite 1%, of the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. So, translating this into a piece of theater, what was sort of your process of getting this on stage?
Well, I wanted to make as engaging a story as I could and make it shorter than my previous play was 90 minutes. And I think that might be a little long, especially if a play is trying to talk about a lot of heavy ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, people, you know, I'm
willing to think, but not for more than an hour.
Yeah. I don't mean it to come out that way. What I mean is, look, I mean, I'm ultimately,
about me personally.
I'm in the entertainment business and people are paying me money, you know, hoping that I've written something that's going to entertain them, and hoping that my actors are going to entertain them. And so, you've got to keep it within a certain length. I think, you know, people are tired. Everybody's got.
I know there's like a window where you're where people are willing to sit and watch what you're presenting, and then when it gets to that point, people start to squirm.
Yeah,
you know? It doesn't matter what's going on stage. It's
well, I've been to a lot of plays, and I'm always struck by the fact that. You know, there's always, even in the plays that I didn't like very much, there's always at least a kernel or two of very interesting ideas.
Yeah.
And I'm always surprised that the playwrights, and I think, well, you already did the hard work by coming up with that idea that I've never seen anywhere else. You know, the easy part is to develop it after that and, you know, make it into a more entertaining part of the play. And it's often they fail to do that. So I tried to follow through all of my original ideas to their logical conclusion.
Yeah.
And with hopefully with hilarious and thought-provoking results.
Yeah.
And I tried to put in lots of conflict. I mean, it's not exactly a paint by numbers exercise. Otherwise, there'd be all kinds of great art out there.
That's right.
But I mean, from my studying what makes the great plays in history, you've got to have conflict. You've got to have a clear sort of storyline, and you've got to be rooting for the heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what people want. I mean, sure, you can have an anti-hero here and there. I mean, some would say my protagonist in my first play was an anti-hero, but. Mm-hmm. But the good guys and the bad guys are very clear in this play. It's almost cartoonish in some ways. So, but there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's to me that's I guess I'm writing the kind of dialogue that I would love to see in plays, and I'm writing the kind of storylines and issues that I would love to see discussed in plays that I just do not see discussed very often.
Yeah, and I think that's the basis for all creative pursuits is we're doing something that we would like to see. And hopefully, hopefully other people share that value in it as well. So, tell us a little about your team, your creative team. Who are the actors that are involved?
Well, my director Nick Effelfinger. I'd seen a play by him, and I was very impressed with his work. So I was able to get him to be my director on this play. And my stage manager Michael Brooks is absolutely excellent, and he's done many plays.
Actually, I know Michael. I did a show with him at the Havana a couple of years ago called Nuts. So. Say hi to him from he wasn't the stage manager. He played the court bailiff.
Yes,
he's a nice guy. Yeah.
Yes, good. He did say he'd done some acting earlier in his career. And we've got a mix. We've got 9 actors, a mix of experienced actors and fairly new actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy with how all of them are bringing the characters to life.
Terrific.
There's a real magic to it. I mean, when you write a play, I've read that a written play. Sitting there on the table is not actually a piece of art because that's only half of the job. It has to be brought to life. It's not like a novel that is a finished piece of art sitting on the table. The play script is, it has to be animated. It has to be brought to life, and you need the right actors.
It was described to me once as a script is not a play. A script is a blueprint. It's like a blueprint is not a building. It's what a building can be made from. That's what we've got here. So now you've got your website up, but as we were saying before we went on the air, the ticket link isn't up yet. But when we get them, you can get them at Theater Wire.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to see if here we go. The website. Tell us about the website.
Oh, publiusproductions.com. I named it after the Roman politician, I guess, general.
Yeah.
Because I really liked, as far as I know, the history of what he was up to.
Yeah.
I really liked what he was trying to do because he was trying to be a voice for the average person in Rome at the time and protecting them from exploitation by the monarchy of the day. So.
All right. So once again, Pieces of Eight, it's going to be at Studio 16 starting on the 19th?
The 21st.
21st, okay.
Night, yes,
okay.
Wednesday the 21st of November.
And publiusproductions.com and Theater Wire. And have you got a Facebook page too?
My people are creating one.
Okay.
well, as soon we don't have it yet.
As soon as you got it, let me know and I'll link it up on the Dave Radio Facebook too. All right, Nathan, thanks a lot for coming in.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're almost out of time, so let's play this, and then we'll be back in just a minute.
Are you a friend of ours who loves to get discounts? Come down to CITR with deals and you can count. We've partnered with some local businesses. So come down to us to get your card before it's too late.
As a member of CITR Discord, you get amazing deals with some of Vancouver's finest local businesses, such as Corner's Pub, Australian Boot Company, The Bike Kitchen, Rufus Guitar Shop, Vinyl Records, and the Cinematheque. For more information, visit CITR.ca/friends.
Tonight is also opening night at United Players at the Jericho Arts Center. It's a classic Greek play called The Suppliant Women by Aeschylus, and it's directed by our own Aeschylus, Adam Henderson. And it is the story of refugee women arriving in Greece, fleeing their homeland and the threat of unwanted marriage. And the questions they ask are, will they be welcomed or sent back to Egypt? And whose laws do they subject? Can the gods offer hope? All kinds of stuff. The tragedy looks at things like forced migration and asks what our obligation is to those fleeing sexual violence and seeking some kind of security. It opens tonight at the Jericho Arts Center, runs until the 2nd of December, and you can find out more by going to unitedplayers.com. All right, it's time now for the Dave Radio call board, featuring auditions and calls for crews support staff for theater productions around Metro Vancouver. Our belief is that auditions announced here should be open to artists of all cultural, sexual, gender, ability, and other identities, and we encourage everyone to read for everything. And to start off, we have a crew call for a comedic workplace web series that's being done here at UBC. It's a student-made web series that will be filmed on campus. It'll be super fun to film, has the potential for multiple episodes, and they're looking for a cinematographer slash videographer, a sound editor, a lighting designer, and a costume designer. And if you want to find out more, the email address is Jordyn, Jordyn, at Roschwerg, it's Roschwerg.com. Let's see. Monday night is the next cold reading series. And I had it. There it is right there. It's also the 25th anniversary of the cold reading series. So it'll be a celebration, a party, and the usual bunch of stuff. It happens at the VFS Cafe, which is at 390 West Hastings. Entry is by donation, suggested around $5. The party starts at 6:00. And casting starts at 6:30. There'll be musical entertainment by people like Adrian Glenlow, Scott Perry, and Sarah Victruck. So all folks that have been on the show here, and plus the usual script reading that will be carrying on, including one by another friend of the show, Raul Sanchez Inglés. So I would be there, but I'm busy doing rehearsals for It's a Wonderful Life, but I will be there in spirit. So check out the Cold Reading Series 25th anniversary party Monday night at the VFS Cafe at Hastings and Hamilton in the sunny downtown east side. Monday, November 19th is the AGM Appalooza, which is the annual general meeting combined for New World Theater, Electric Company, Rumble, the Chop Theater, and Frank. That's happening at Progress Lab 1422, which is 1422 William Street. There's a $5 entry fee that includes your membership on all five of those theater companies, and there will be a short presentation from each company giving an outline of what they've been up to and what their plans are in the future, and then you break off into groups, you pick the company that you want to participate in, and you do the usual AGM stuff, elect a board, approve budgets and minutes and that kind of thing, and that happens as quickly as possible, and then it all breaks down into a big old kind of party. So that's Monday, November 19th at 1422 William. Circle Bright Productions is looking for a production assistant to help in the production of The 39 Steps, which will be on stage at the Norman Rothstein Theater in March. You go to circlebrightproductions.com to find out more about that. Deadline is November 23rd. Deep Cove Stage Society is still looking for someone to play the Dame in their Christmas panto Santa in Space. Deep Cove Stage Society. Let's see. There's an email, santainspacepanto@gmail.com, for more information on that. There's a SMP Dramatic Society looking for an actor for its panto, The Not So Little Mermaid. This one's going on in January at St. Martin's Church in North Vancouver. They're specifically looking for a male in his 20s with good comedic timing. SMPDramatics.com for more information on that. Rabbit Hole at Vagabond Players. Their auditions are happening November 11th and 14th at the Burnie Leg Theater in New Westminster. Metro Theater's Up and Coming. Auditions are November 12th and 13th at Metro Theater in Marpole. Distress Signal is doing The Sacred Pigeon, an hour-long original sketch comedy commenting on religious beliefs and spiritual tendencies. The auditions for that are at the Go Studios at 3rd and Main on November the 16th. That's a week from now. And let's see, the rest of this is going on further on in the future, so we don't need to worry about that right now, because lo and behold, it looks like we're out of time. That's it. That's our show. Thanks for spending your lunch hour with us. We're reviving the Dave Radio shout-out for friends of the show. Kevin Michael Cripps, who is heading to the UK next month to take on position of head of singing at Guildford School of Acting at the University of Surrey in London, England. Kevin is a longtime actor and musical director in Vancouver, and the musical theater performance instructor and vocal coach at Capilano. So congratulations for Kevin for moving up and moving out, and all the best in the future for you. Remember, if you have a song that needs airplay, a show that needs audience, an audition that needs actors, a class that needs students, or a film shoot that needs background, we're here for you. You can send your details to DaveRadioPodcast@hotmail.com, and you can like us on Facebook. And on Twitter and Instagram, we're at CITR Dave Radio. If you missed any or all of today's show or want to relive glorious moments from the past, check out our podcast archive at CITR.ca. And stick around, because Audrey's coming in next with Too Dreamy, followed by Beppe Crespin Presents at 2, and Nardwar the Human Serviette at 3:30. Dave Radio will not return next week. We are being preempted for 24 Hours of Student Power, a special presentation of student programming that's running from 9 p.m. Thursday night to 9 p.m. Friday night next week. But we'll be back here in 2 weeks. So thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute. Just visit CITR.ca/Discorder/contribute. You can grab it around town or read it at Discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.